Hello, everyone. So I guess I'm going as the first speaker, and in part will kind of set a context, set a historical perspective, and go through a little bit of the overview of race and racism and mental health. And I'm sure that as the other speakers come on, we'll have some more specific programs that will sort of illustrate what we're talking about here. So I will tell you a little bit about what I'm doing in New York, but towards the end. But first, I wanted to start essentially at the beginning. Okay, do I have? Okay. So with all the other isms that you could possibly think of, why is it that we're focusing on race as and its impact on health and mental health? So, everyone belongs to a professional organization, and there are mandates, policy positions, ethical statements. I'm going to share two that, of course, govern my work as a psychotherapist and also as a special educator. I didn't put the CEC up there. But looking at the APA says that racism has been shown to have a negative cognitive and behavioral effective and relational effects on both child and adult, nationally, globally, and that this is why we're looking at race. Okay. As the ideals that we hold in our profession, they put forth, the APA put forth as part of the resolution in 2001, that racism and racial discrimination as a policy statement in support of the goals of the 2001 World Conference Against Racism and Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Tolerance. Psychologists and other social scientists have established that racism, racial discrimination, ethnic conflict, and violence are pervasive and persisting challenges here in the United States, but also globally. NASW, which I'm on a particular project with called the Undoing Racism Internship Project. Nationwide, what we've come up with is that the primary mission of social work profession is to enhance human well-being and to help meet the basic needs of all people, with particular attention to the needs of empowerment of people who are vulnerable, oppressed, and living in poverty. Social workers are sensitive to cultural and ethnic diversity and strive to end discrimination, oppression, and poverty, and all forms of social injustice. And that's why racism and its impact is a social justice issue. It's not just a mental health issue, although we know that it has an absolute impact on the health and well-being of all, including those who are not our patients, but those who are. Okay. So, if we look primarily at the African American experience in the changing state, we have to start at the beginning. And so when we look at this visual, we see that for 223 years, there was the enslavement. If we look then at the next portion of history, we have the Reconstruction, which is another 102 years, and post-civil rights, we're 45 years into it, 45 years only. And so a lot of what we see is this long-standing history of inequities and injustice within the systems that run our government and our society. So we've only had 45 years, so we have a lot more work to do. We've done a lot, but there's a lot more to do. And in totality, we've done pretty well for 45 years post-civil rights, the enactment of post-civil rights legislation. So, one of the things that we'll do today, of course, is look at the history because that's the context. And policies, most of our institutions are based in policies and practices that come from separate but equal, okay? And so we're gonna look a little bit at that very briefly to see how that impacts health and well-being in 2010. So. Census 2002, we just had 10, didn't get the statistics for 10, but they're pretty similar, is that what we see is that people of color are more likely to be uninsured, which of course significantly reduces access to preventive care, which then also impacts the long-term and longevity of our clients. So 11% of whites are said to have be uninsured. It doubles with African-Americans almost, and triples with Latinos. And other groups may vary, but we just picked out these three for now. Okay, so what we want to do is look at IOM. In 1999, they were charged at assessing what are some of the health disparities. If they exist, what are they? And make recommendations for healthcare professions. What in 2002, once the results came back, what they did decide, which is something that comes debatable all the time, does racial disparities really exist? Well, yes, they do. That's what they came back with. Racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare do exist. And because they're associated with some of the worst health outcomes, we have to find them totally unacceptable. As racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare occur in the context of a broader historic perspective, that's why we're looking at some of those issues over time. So, the GI Bill, in theory, really a good thing, right? When veterans came back from the war, they needed housing to stay in. But what we have is something, a piece of legislation that actually speaks to part of a huge part of the disparity between wealth, education, health in our time. Prior to the GI Bill, most people had to put 50% down for their housing, right? After the GI Bill, we have the current 30-year mortgage became part of it with the development of the Federal Housing Administration. And what they did was say, we're going to have certain risk factors that will say whether or not you get to partake in the GI Bill. So many people had this GI Bill, but they couldn't do anything with it. And when you look historically at it, where do we build most of our wealth is in our property. So if you were not able to get the mortgage, this is where we have our segregated neighborhoods come up. I'm a fan, even though I shouldn't say, of like Eminem on one level, but not on another. And he talks about 8 Mile in Detroit. Well, 8 Mile was actually a redlining project. The people on the other side of the 8 Miles were not able to get housing mortgages because they were too close to the people of color neighborhoods. So what did they do? They built a wall at the 8 Mile marker, and then they were able to buy their homes. Of course, the people on the other side were not. And so we build our wealth in that, in our homes. This is a map from the 1930s that shows just how redlining was done and where redlining occurred in our country. And you see, it's pretty much all over. So, why is this important to health and healthcare? Because racial segregation has been shown to be a consistent predictor of health outcomes and a partial explanation about racial health disparities. There have been links between segregation and health disparities in a way that has shown infant mortality, adult mortality, tuberculosis, asthma, depression, anxiety, hospital admissions, the location of food stores, which of course affects your health, the availability of pharmaceuticals, which also affects your health, high availability of liquor stores, one on corners, and tobacco advertisement, which also is health. I said at the top that I'm also a special educator, so one of the other things that I look at are how health impacts education and overrepresentation of particularly African-American boys within the more restrictive classifications like emotional disturbance and mental retardation. They're overrepresented. And part of this has to do with, once again, where you go to school, who's there, who's identifying you. So, what I'm asking today in this kind of overview setup is for us to take a journey together. And in that journey, what we want to do is to analyze manifestations of racism, okay? Because what we come to the table with definitely impacts how we view our clients, patients, and how we evaluate them, how we treat them, how we gatekeep, how we let information in and out, is what we come to the party with. So we're going to look at, I want to say, that we'll look at internalized racial oppression, which is a concept that we really need to at least leave today thinking about, is if we live in a racialized society, and mind you that at this place in 2010, we no longer think of race as biologically based. We understand it as a social construction. That's why it varies from country to country and from place to place. Who's black in America is not black in the Philippines. You know, so we understand it that it's socially constructed. But it is a racialized society that we live in, so how we internalize the messages impacts how we deal with one another. And one of the ways that people of color can internalize racism, one is by buying into the stereotypes that are put out in the world, thinking of themselves as inferior, and thus behaving in such a way. That's one way. Or we can totally switch up and say, well, I'm not going to buy into it, and go all the way to the other end, where we totally assimilate into giving up part of the culture. So there are many ways that we take this negative, stereotypical image of ourselves and change it or buy into it in such a way that causes us stress. So we have a lot of self-medicating. We have I work a lot with youth, and I know we're going to hear more about youth, who will do everything the opposite not to have the society look at them one way, not to be powerless. On the other hand, we have something called racial superiority, which is something that people do who you buy into the fact that being white in America is a positive thing. It doesn't mean that any of this is conscious. Most of this is on a subconscious level, okay? And so, but we need to be able to, in reflective practice, to get at some of the subtext of why we do the things that we do. Why do we view this child this way and not this child that way? Why do we over-diagnose certain conditions in certain populations but not in others? And it's about how we view them based on the way society has played out. Okay, so naming and reflecting and analyzing are the first steps to overcoming the debilitating effects of racism. We are all affected by racism, not all of us. Not one of us can move in this society and not be affected in some way. So once we leave, what I would like people to do is to kind of have some questions for consideration. If we had all day, we would be doing this together, but you can take it back and do it in your places, your organizations, agencies, institutions. And one is to identify and understand the manifestations of racism that we experience, our own place that we locate racism. How do these manifestations affect our personal and professional learning? So what do we do with them? You know, once we identify them, and that's the hardest place to do, because most of us think of ourselves as good people, and we are, that's why we're in the helping professions. However, internalized racism affects us all, and we sometimes act out on it. So how does it manifest within our professional experiences? And lastly, and the most important part probably, is how does it affect outcomes for our clients or patients. Okay. This is probably where most of my professional work lies, in this Reflections for Progress. These are things that we actually can do. I said that I work on something called the Undoing Racism Internship Project, and what it is in New York we have an initiative that has located all 13 schools of social work, and we have interns that work on the project to bring this anti-racist practice lens to social work education. So that's part of the integration of anti-racist analysis with across the curriculum, is that we have several schools, NYU, Stony Brook, Hunter, who have actually initiated a race and diversity curriculum so that their students have it as part of their policy. Doesn't matter, there are several concentrations, and they all take part in this anti-racist practice. At Brooklyn College, I also teach for special educators the anti-racist practice course, which is called Diversity in Inclusive Settings. And so bringing it to the curricula is one way that we want to do in preparation for people who will go out into the field. The other is to, for those of us who are clinicians or practitioners out in the field, do you actually, many of us go through psychoanalysis, right, psychotherapy, because we have to, no, because we should, and the other of us, we are in reflective supervision, but do we bring race to the table as a topic for reflection with our supervisors? And so your supervisor may or may not be comfortable with it, you as a supervisor may not be, but it's a challenge for us to get comfortable so that we can bring that to it, to supervision. Maintaining accountability. People should not be comfortable saying things in our presence. Many of the students that I supervise, as well as some of the clinicians, talk about how someone will say something in their presence because they share a like ethnicity or a like race, but they would never say it in a more diverse group. And they say, well, how do I deal with that, Candida? And so that becomes part of the supervision. How do you deal with it? How do you maintain accountability to each other and to the disciplines so that we don't let it just stay in the air, okay? Or we're so uncomfortable that we don't do anything. The increased workforce diversity, many people actually have grants to do this, so that if you have many voices in the workforce, the conversation becomes richer and it's something to build on. So that's another one, workforce. We have someone who actually has a workforce grant to bring diversity to nursing. I actually was part of one for special education some 15 years ago to bring diverse teachers to practice. And then lastly, to develop leadership. And so when I'm in this room today with everyone, I'm thinking there are many leaders in this room, people who are in administrative positions or in places that can actually make a difference at this level, but it has to happen at all.